Welcome back, friends. This is Ron Jacobs, your host for ArtCast, where today we are cracking open the archives. Yeah, about a year ago, I was in London doing an event on Enterprise Library, and I sat down with Clemens Vasters and Arvindra Semi. Now, at the time, Clemens was working for Newtelligence AG, and you'll hear him say that. Today, he actually works for Microsoft. He got sucked in to the vortex here in Redmond. But we had a fascinating conversation, and since that time, 1 year ago, I've received a lot of mail from people who really, really enjoyed this particular podcast. So I said, you know what? One of these days, I'm going to crack open the archives and just put that one back on the air. So this is the day. We're going to do it again with Clemens and Arvindra. Let's give them a warm welcome, everybody.
Hey, this is Ron Jacobs, and I am here at the Microsoft UK headquarters. This is the headquarters, right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And here in Reading. And so I took a ride on the Reading Railroad today. Yeah, so that was my big revelation. I've been playing Monopoly my whole life, and I never understood what the Reading Railroad was until today when I rode on it. I don't know if I passed go or not, but nobody handed me any money, so I don't think I did. nonetheless, I'm sitting here with Vin and Clemens, so I'm going to allow you guys to introduce yourselves. Just tell us your name and what you do. Okay, we'll start with Vin.
All right, I'm Arvindra Semi, and I'm the lead architect for Microsoft EMEA headquarters, based in the UK.
Okay, and Clemens?
My name is Clemens Vasters. I'm CTO of Newtelligence AG, a consulting company in Germany, and I'm a Microsoft regional director.
Okay, great. And so we had a nice event here today about Enterprise Library, and I was delighted to see Clemens and Vin. In fact, Clemens, I think you and I have been running into each other at events for years now. I remember probably 4 or 5 years ago, back when I was on the ComPlus team, you were working with us on some stuff way back then, right?
We started as an independent entity in 2000. That's when we fled from our old employer. And since then, we've been interacting with various groups at Redmond. We wanted to be a little components company, and then someone knew someone at Microsoft, and they liked us really much. And then all of a sudden, we get thrown into this whole space, and it was so. Since then, things keep being interesting.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. And I know Vin. I think I first met you in Barcelona.
Yes, I remember that. A beautiful terrace at the Barcelona Arts Hotel overlooking the Mediterranean Ocean. Remember?
That's right. Yeah, I remember. And you took us to the flamenco dancers.
Oh, yeah.
That was great. Yeah.
I won't tell them what you did.
Okay, well, we shouldn't leave.
At the time, I was probably drunk at Porto Olimpico.
All right, so we were just sitting around here thinking, what are we going to talk about? So, Vin, what was the subject you were saying?
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of debate around how you actually conceptualize business problems and then go from those business problem conceptualizations to realizations running on our platform technologies. And we've got great tools. We've got great software engineering techniques for actually building systems. But there's a big gap still between the actual conceptualization of the actual business problem and then actually realizing it. The gap is not addressed by the tools explicitly. It's not addressed by any design methodology. And I think it's important for people to start understanding how to address this gap. Currently, it's very ad hoc. There are some very experienced people that have built systems. But just like any sort of knowledge engineering task, it's very difficult for experts to articulate what they do to fill that gap. And I think that's just an interesting conversation to have.
Okay, so I think you'd have to give me some examples because I'm not sure I understand what the nature of this gap is. Can you give me an example?
Okay, so let's take, for example, this whole area of service orientation. Mm-hmm. Right? And people talk about implementing systems that are service-oriented using service-oriented architectures. And right now, my current feeling is that people are struggling to do that, and as a result, they're not realizing the benefits that are promised from taking a service-oriented approach to building systems. And I think the reason is that they're taking their existing ideas and notions of how to build systems using, let's say, object-oriented analysis and design, and that doesn't really translate into building service-based systems. And I think there really is a need for service-oriented analysis and design. And that service-oriented analysis and design allows you to surface some very specific new kinds of artifacts that people aren't really used to in building these kind of systems. And those artifacts are things like contracts, message schemas, policies, message exchange patterns. And I think that is the kind of stuff that goes into that gap. And we need some techniques for understanding how to surface those artifacts and how to identify those artifacts. And I think that is the missing piece. We need tooling. We need best practice guidance. Patterns and Practices is a perfect organization to actually produce that information for us.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Yeah, that's great. what were your thoughts, Clemens?
I agree with Vin, as I usually do. But I don't think we need new things. I think what we need is archaeology.
Archaeology. Okay. Interesting.
I think we need archaeology. We
so
need
a new look at an old thing, maybe.
Yes. I think what we need for so first of all, there's was one term that was said, which I meanwhile don't agree with anymore, and that's service-oriented architecture. I think there's service orientation and there's architecture,
that's
and you can
it.
Combine them. But there's architecture as is a completely separate thing from service orientation. But to reach a way to define your architecture and then to find out what services are, I think there is already a model existing, and we need to look back into history to find it. I mean, it seems like a strange approach, but I think there is potential there. Think about a huge building. Think about a big company that functions, where communication functions, it actually gets business done. Think about a huge building. Think about the MetLife building on Union Square. Now, you may think the MetLife building is right in the middle of Park Avenue. No, that's not what I mean. I mean the MetLife building in Union Square in New York in 1920. Huge building, big company, works. No computer. How did that work? Interesting part is it worked because they were moving paper around. They had processes. They knew how to do things. It was all well defined how to do it was all well defined which form goes where, what goes on which form. It was well defined how the message channels were. They were all, interestingly enough, one way. So you would actually or they were star based. So you would go and throw a paper in a bucket, and then the mail boy would come around and grab it, and then it would go to the mail distribution center, will be put into the other buckets, and then just sent off. So it would be a queue-based thing. And interestingly, those organizations worked. Were they as efficient as they are today? Of course not. But if we just take the same concept, if we just take the same idea of moving messages along, of having proper schemas, which forms are, and build systems in that way. If we conceptualize roles in an organization, such as this old insurance, as roles that can be taken on by people or by services, and then if we distinguish between roles that take deterministic tasks and roles that are taking on non-deterministic tasks, you have deterministic things where you have where you can apply rules that are well-known, where you have calculations that are well-known. You have non-deterministic things where you need to make a decision based on weak stuff that floats around in the atmosphere. Non-deterministic tasks are taken on by people, and they get messages, and they deal with those messages, and they yield messages. Deterministic tasks are communicated by messages, and they are taken on by deterministic entities, which are computer programs, and they yield messages again. So you have a workflow that flows around in your organization. You have digital employees and you have real employees, and they all work together on workflows. So it's a workflow-centric idea, and you have forms floating around. You have well-defined messages floating around. It's workflow. It's process-centric, and on that process are hanging interactive tasks and are automated tasks. That's what I think where we need to go.
Okay, I like that picture because as you were talking about that, I was thinking back to remembering a time when I actually designed a form. I don't know if you ever had to do any of this way back and when, but, you know, we thought a lot about how should this form be laid out and how long should this thing be and, you know, what should go here and there. We thought a lot about is it complete? Does it have everything on? Because it was expensive. I mean, you're going to produce this form and then send it to a printer. It had to produce so many copies. If you messed up the form, it was really expensive to throw a whole bunch of them out and create new ones. Maybe because the mechanics of getting messages around in the MetLife building in the 1920s involved these long-running processes. It forced people into a way of thinking and designing their processes that was different than what we've come to now. And I think I agree with what you're saying. We have to look back. Now, I'm wondering, Vin, how we can connect this thought with what you were talking earlier about going from a business problem to the realization of a solution. So to me, it seems like at the bottom level, what people are really after is a way of thinking of building systems that fit into that process-oriented model instead of building the silos that resist the process orientation. And so we're trying to get to we have new tools and techniques that are available to us now that weren't available before. How do we think about the business problem in that process-centric way?
Well, I mean, many people have tried to investigate that specific problem, and we all know the early 90s fashion for business process reengineering. A lot of the thinking that came out of there has evolved in the last decade or so. And in fact, Microsoft have, in the last 5 to 10 years, been working on what we call module maps or capability maps. And this is now becoming a methodology which is going to be known as Motion. And in the Microsoft Consulting Services are now pushing Motion out to our customers as a way in which to engage with the enterprise customer for precisely allowing them to conceptualize their business in terms of capabilities. And the nice thing about describing organizations in terms of capabilities as opposed to process, optimized processes, is that the capability can have associated with it service level agreements, which are attached to the operations or functions that the capability offers. And those artifacts can be mapped nicely onto the kind of artifacts that you require for a service-oriented view of your organization as well. So people are finding the connection between the Motion methodology or module map and capabilities and service orientation is a very good connection, and that gives us one clue as to how we can move towards actually realizing and building systems.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So just for me to understand it, so this you have a capability is – no, you have a piece of your organization.
Yes.
And that piece of organization has several capabilities, which are operations that can be performed?
So the capabilities are modeled at several levels of abstraction. At the highest level, there are five core capabilities of a business. One is to actually produce products. The other one is to create demand generation for those products. The other one is to actually – fulfill the demand and delivery of those products. And the other one is about sort of organizational processes. And the other one is, the final one is about collaboration. So these five top-level capabilities can in turn be decomposed to low-level capabilities. And the idea is that once you've gone to two or three levels of decomposition of those capabilities, you're at a point at which you can then associate these capabilities with these kind of artifacts that can be translated into an actual implementation. And the implementation is either a computer software program, or the functions of the capability are actually delivered by humans. So this is the sort of connection point with what Clemens was talking about earlier on. And I think it's a very compelling approach. I think where it actually becomes complex is when you need to think about the actual messages and the data that's being conveyed between the different operations across multiple different capabilities. So you start having problems of actually modeling the message exchange patterns. And those exchange patterns can become quite complex because the exchange patterns can occur between and amongst automatic systems as well as manual systems. So some of these message exchanges occur over short periods of time, and sometimes they occur over very long periods of time. So there's the whole issue of state management and persistence and correlation of a message exchange within a particular context. So these are all difficult problems, and I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of people are struggling to build these kinds of systems.
And one thing that I would like to add, and the complexity is that as we surface information to the end user, so to the people who play a role in fulfill the non-deterministic role in that sort of process, we need to sort of turn around the control from the user to the system. And what I mean by this is that in most workflow and workflow-driven environments, which are very, very many administrative workflows, probably the majority of business systems, there is knowledge in the system what work is there to do. I can give someone a very precise list of the things that are on his schedule. I can send them today. People are sent at most in most systems reminders of, you know, this is what's on your list. But software is very disrespectful and insulting in a way that we still make them go through main menu to find the right tool for the task at hand, even though software can be intelligent enough to serve up the appropriate UI for that task. So I go and send a message to an individual. That message lands in some form of inbox, and for reasons of simplicity, make that Outlook. In Outlook, there's a plugin, and the plugin recognizes the purpose of that message. So if we really want to go to very, very deep down in plumbing, it will look at the WS addressing action header, and will say, oh, I have a way to make this more manageable for the person here. So it pulls up a proper form. The proper form is a wizard, really. I mean, just a couple of steps that need to be there to do that task. It will pull in reference data that's needed to fulfill that task. Typically, those things are short decision things. Probably an analysis. It probably needs to pull up some additional things, but it's really a short work step. And then when you're done, you say finish and it yields a message and it throws that message back into the workflow. So workflow drives tasks. Workflow drives user interaction, and the way the systems communicate with the user is much in the same way that people communicate with people, and that's through their inbox, through a mailbox system. And integrating this, for instance, into a tool like Outlook is for me the most natural way to involve people into a workflow. So I think with service orientation, if we take this seriously, applications that act on user commands in the way that the user really drives where the application goes, these are going to go and die.
You know, I like that picture. In fact, I was thinking about how, you know, you get different kind of messages in Outlook today, right? You get a meeting request, you open that, you get a different form than if you get an email.
There you go.
Wouldn't it be great if you got, a new insurance policy that needs to be reviewed by somebody who's selling them. And, yeah.
You get a credit application. You can review the credit application in Outlook and you approve or disapprove. Done.
So you've got context-driven UIs and the context is contained in the message.
Oh, I think that's great. Yeah.
I think this is a beautiful idea because it means that you can actually target the actual kind of type of interaction you have based upon the actual type of device that the message is arriving on.
Yeah, and you know what else is great about that is that it really lowers sort of the training bar, right? Because people are used to Outlook, they're used to that environment, and it would be very easy to natural to come up and use some. Of course, when VSTO arrives, they'll have some wonderful support for this, and our team has contributed a couple of people to see that happen, so I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, but just imagine the message arrived on your smartphone.
Yeah.
Right? You would require a different kind of human interaction mechanism on the smartphone. And the the display could be rendered based upon the display type.
Yeah.
And given the given the device's capabilities and given the actual context that's held in the message itself.
So if you were having an infrastructure that knows your whereabouts, and this would be playing into, you know, I still like the whole, I dare not even say it because I'm amongst Microsoft people, but I still like some of the ideas of .NET My Services, especially presence, mm-hmm. and knowing which device you're on. Mm-hmm. So you get a message of that sort. So you are a banker who needs to approve a credit. And you say, I'm present at this and this device. So you're signed in, and you're present at a mobile phone. Mm-hmm. With your presence, you would have notification filters that say, only notify me if I have to approve credits over, you know, $100,000, mm-hmm. Or over $1 million, because they tend to be very very profitable, et cetera, et cetera. So these are things that I need to know about. But notify me. Don't deliver that message yet because I can't handle it. But notify me. So there's a spin-off of that message, which is a notification, which goes to the mobile device.
Right.
And then he can go to a desktop computer where he can see all the richness of all the data that he needs to have, and then he can process this there. And then he can have a filter. And otherwise, he will not be notified, and the message just sits in his inbox, and he processes it as he goes.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of things. There's a lot of things that you can do with a message-driven, with a service-oriented approach to user interfaces, as opposed to a system that's, you know, you need to start an app and then you start working in that app. The mm-hmm. the app should come to you and involve you in existing process.
So do you think, Clemens, that the message could actually contain the UI inside the message?
No.
For example, let's say the UI was described as XAML.
I don't think that's the right thing to do, because the UI will reside on or be accessible from the design the presentation surface where you are. So you could imagine there would be a service which acts as the UI broker, if you will.
Okay.
So you get a message and that has an action. You don't have a cached UI for it. So you reach out to a service. The service has UI, let's say XAML information for you. You pull that in, and then you run that UI on your system. What that also opens the possibility. If you have, let's say you have a generalized sort of workflow, or generalized entering address data, like a common sort of thing. There's a lot of unemployed designers, right?
Okay.
So what I think is we can have a proper, with this, we can truly have a proper separation of design and data in a way that once you have a reasonably good framework around this idea, and you punt messages, real application level SOAP messages out to a UI, all of a sudden you can outsource the whole design of your UIs to people who really know how that works. If you take XAML, for instance, you have data binding capabilities, how they can bind to all the reference data. And they can get the XML message, they can bind to the XML, they can really bind to the XML message. And then you should switch off your phone while we're talking. you have designers can actually work on those things in a much more efficient way because they have a smaller surface to cover. They only take care of one task. And that also, you know, you can pretty much forget about what the source of the message is. Many, many systems can send messages to users. And still, since you have a bunch of designers working on those application surfaces, you can still show them in a unified, consistent design because you have a design. People who do the design take care of all those things. They don't really care about what the apps are.
Do you think, though? I mean, it seems like we're a ways away from an app that's purely XAML that I can go off and fetch and bind to some data in a message.
Click once is just as good.
Yeah.
Go and go. You just have to have a store.
Yeah.
And that store is just points you to a URL, and that URL is a .application file.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's it. And you just go, you download it using click once, you pass in the message in whatever wonderful way you like, and let that be whatever IPC communication mechanism comes to mind. Or you simply, and that's much easier, you tell the application, there's the message, go fetch it.
Yeah.
And then you have a Windows Forms wizard, 1, 2, 3, yield message this way, done.
Yeah.
So that's, this is very intriguing. So Clemens, remember the conversation you were having with Pat Helland and Rafael during the nerd suit and fortune teller gig that you did at TechEd last year? You were talking about the user as a service.
That's exactly what I think.
So this is basically what we've been discussing, really, is to start treating the user as a service, where the user actually receives messages, but in addition to that, also receives subject-specific UI in order to process that message in the context of the task.
And even though it sounds cruel, as a way of thinking about people, this is exactly what people do towards an organization. That's what they're hired for. They're hired to function in a set of roles, and to accept jobs and to deliver results in those jobs. They are non-deterministic, sometimes too non-deterministic, services.
Well, and then actually, if you do that, then maybe eventually the AI will get good enough that we could just replace the people.
Yeah, and I don't think that will ever happen.
No, I don't think that will ever happen. No,
but but that's, I think that's the most productive way to involve people, and that's actually if you have a system like this, you can involve. You can be much more creative about your business processes. Reshaping business processes is just a matter of changing the orchestration between all those pieces.
Right. Okay. Well, hey, this has been really interesting.
Very
I think
cool.
we came on to some interesting stuff there. So thanks, guys, for joining.
Clemens and Arvindra, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, that was, even 1 year ago, think about how much has changed in a year. But these guys were way ahead of the game, okay? They were already thinking about WPF and WCF and how we're going to use all these things. Don't you like the way we're thinking about humans as services? I like that. I think it's good because it helps us to connect the human factor to service-oriented architecture. And that's really crucial that we get that right, because really people are the ones making decisions, and we have to connect them to the process. Well, anyway, I knew you'd like that one because it's been very, very popular. And if you like it, send me a note, let me know. ron.jacobs@microsoft.com. And we'll see you next time on ArtCast.